So, Dave, I just want to be clear about your answer of advocating overflying Canada. Are you saying we can do that because it's perfectly legal, we meet all the requirements of flying through Canada's airspace without landing there and any about crossing the border? Or are you saying you don't care because it's just not going to matter to have all those T's crossed and I's dotted? No one is ever going to know. And so just go ahead and do it because it's safer.
Yeah, I'm just going where the good weather is. And if the good weather happens to be on the other side of the border, let's go there. We're not breaking any rules by doing that. It's just a sound aeronautical decision.
Now, are we really not breaking any rules? If we're just overflying Canadian airspace, we're in Canadian airspace, do we have to worry about having a radio station license on board? Do we have to worry about being VFR and flying a flight notification or being on a flight plan? Is that an issue that we have to think about? Does anybody have a good answer? I'm really curious. I'm not sure I know.
Just a quick plug for the AOPA's Pilot Information Center. These guys are experts at these sorts of questions, and I went downstairs and asked them. What they pointed out to me was that 91707, to do a VFR border crossing with Canada, you should really file a flight plan, but you never actually have to activate it. The rule is that a flight plan should be filed, but where the rubber meets the road, the controllers don't care. If you're radar identified and on the radio, they will just treat you like any other airborne traffic.
You know, on one of my, again, when you're looking at these scenarios, you're trying to figure out how to be in the head of the person flying rather than with your own knowledge, because knowing that my understanding was you can go cross into Canada, come back out. As long as you didn't land there, the customs isn't an issue. So my inclination as me with that knowledge is, hey, I'm going to go what you just said. Why be in bad weather when you can be in good weather further north, and knowing it doesn't have any consequences, that's what I'd do. If I wasn't sure, though, if I was doubtful, I think I might be breaking a law. I might be getting sideways with the regulations where I'm seeing that paint and wanting to stay on the side that keeps me clean and legal. My choice was going to be to fly along the lake because I still have the exit route to the north. I'm going to stay on the best side of the weather I possibly can, hug that border. But I also know I don't have towers. If I have an emergency, I can get back to land. But I also know that the biggest problem I have if I'm flying low is towers. And if I'm not familiar with this area, being over the lake gives me the one margin of safety I have with an exit plan to the right.
Well, the concern I had about the option of flying over Canada wasn't about Canadian airspace at all. And I'm not 100% up to speed on the requirements there. But I made the assumption that what I think is correct, in which case an overflight is not that big of a deal. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that at least part of the way across the lake, we're underneath a low overcast, we have reduced visibility, potentially showers, and I'm concerned about the disorientation that might occur flying visually low over water in a low visibility environment. I'm more concerned about that. So my inclination would be to treat this exercise the way that I successfully treat lines of thunderstorms. Fly as far as you safely can, flying essentially mentally from airport to airport, thinking that this is my alternate, and then each time as I go past one, decide whether or not I can continue to the next one. Land when I have to, so get as far as I can, land, let the bad weather blow over, and it looks like the forecast is improving even faster, or the weather's improving even faster than forecast to the west. I might have to get up very early the next morning to make the rest of the flight, but I would tend to go as far as I safely could and then let it blow past.
Yeah, I'm with Dave on this one. I'd much rather deal with some little bureaucratic nuances if I have to than listen to that big engine sounding rough out over the water. I can't do that. At 2,000 feet on that airplane over the water, I'd have a heart attack before I got that done.
Now, what if the weather in Canada was sort of equally bad? So that, you know, the Canadian side, it's just more of the same, and it's, you know, with fewer airports to go to. What would be your move around here?
I grew up trying to fly aerobatic airplanes with nothing but, in the beginning, a compass, then an unreliable RNAV system when it in at a Loran, and then finally with GPS, and that was the hallelujah moment for guys that were trying to fly VFR cross country. And for me, the cloud height isn't really the problem. It's really the visibility. And so if I'm going to fly VFR under the clouds at low altitude, but there's no rain, I don't worry about it. But if there's rain, like you see here, it becomes an issue. And as Tom just said, when he's talking about flying at thunderstorms, point to point to point, that's the way that I would fly in low weather in my aerobatic airplane. Is I would go to an airport, to another airport, to another airport, to another airport, and literally not in a straight line, from a runway to a runway to a runway to a runway. And it's going to take me a little bit longer to get there, but I'm always within, you know, 15 miles of an airport, maybe 20 at the max, and then understanding that the visibility is going to come down and go up. But for those VFR pilots that are stuck in a situation like that, once you see light rain on the radar, you have to get nervous, because that's where the danger comes in. It's in the rain showers.
And in those visibilities. So you're feeling okay, we have visibilities 5 to 10 miles basically at the moment here, and some IFR ceilings. You're feeling okay with continuing if you can do that airport to airport hop?
My plan would have been to just get off the shoreline, and knowing that area really well, I look at, I think it's Cuyahoga County is right on the shoreline, and then I think Burke Lakefront is my next one, and then I think Sandusky, Ohio is my next one, and then I have to make a decision, okay, I'm about to leave sort of the comfort of the shoreline, so navigation isn't a problem as long as I'm hugging the shoreline, but now I'm going to be at a lower altitude, starting to press out over into the plains and the flat area, where navigating towers and the visibility and looking down to try to look at my iPad to see where I am, that becomes more of a challenge. So for me, once I got to the bottom end of the lake near Sandusky, Ohio, and I had to venture out towards my destination, then that for me, that would be a go, no-go point as to whether I would continue, depending upon what the weather was.
And, you know, to Tom's point earlier, you know, one of the things I would agree, you know, when I said I want to be over the water, I want to be over the water just to make sure I'm not, that's my way of clearing towers without having to look, have my head down looking at a chart. I'm keeping my eyes out. But his point is really well taken. You're up there in gray clouds with gray water. If you don't have that shoreline as a visual, you are in big trouble right away, because you just made yourself IFR without even having to have IFR visibilities, because as soon as you lose a horizon and have gray in front, gray below, nothing to give you a horizon, it doesn't really matter whether it's legal visibility or legal IFR, you are in disorientation space. So you really have to have the visual for it to be anywhere approaching, you know. And then the other challenge, I think, with this kind of scenario, the best choice is get north, get to where the visibilities are clearly VFR. But if you are going to stay the course and stay on path, what happens with scud running is, you know, you're up there really as high, you're wanting to get as much altitude as possible, but then you're in that low ragged deck where you're losing visibility. That's where your danger zone is. So, you know, you get pushed down because you get better visibility. So as long as you have that 10 miles, you're good. But, you know, you're trying to stay high, and those clouds are pushing you down, and if you get your head in the clouds a little bit, you lose the visibility, and again, you're in disorientation fairly quickly. So it's where you've got bad decisions getting pushed on you by trying to stay low.
I find this kind of flying is pretty fatiguing, because you are really paying a lot of attention and looking out forward and gauging your visibility and where you're going. And I also find that what you would decide to do in this scenario differs based on the airplane you're flying. And in this case, it has an awful lot to do with speed. So, for example, I fly a Super Cub a lot. A Super Cub at, you know, 90 miles an hour, you can go pretty low with good visibility and feel very comfortable, because, you know, you're measuring your airspeed with a calendar. So, you know, now you're flying this airplane, the Harvard, we're a lot faster. Your forward visibility isn't that good. So you might make a different answer depending on the airplane you're flying.
Well, at what point is it scud running? I mean, the term kind of came out here. Like, when is it reasonable low altitude flying and acceptable visibilities? And when is it scud running in the sense of this is dangerous and I should not be doing it?
Well, I I've written several times, I personally define scud running as a flight at a cruising altitude that is less than what is normal for you. And it's not necessarily that you have to stop what you're doing at that point, but it's a region of heightened awareness where I have to be aware. I need to do things differently because I'm lower than I normally would be. In my personal case, that's probably below 3,000 feet above ground level. I'm always in something lower than it is normal. So what I like to do is to look at the sector altitudes on the sectional charts and maintain at least 500 feet above that. If for any reason I have to go below 500 feet above that, the altitude of the sector in which I'm in at that point, that's when I call it, and I'm going to land at the closest airport. So the altitude that defines scud running is, as Richard said, going to be in large part airplane dependent because less speed gives you more options. But in all cases, you need to be defining a minimum altitude that is acceptable for you and your airplane at that time, and that minimum altitude is going to vary along the way, and have the discipline to say that I am going to go down to 1,000 feet MSL, but not 1 foot lower. If the conditions require me to go lower to stay in the visibility I need, that's when I'm going to turn around and land at the closest airport.
You know, just a tip from some Alaska pilots who do a lot of this type of flying, and they sort of pick up on what Mike was saying about it's avoid the ragged bottoms, and their point is it's better to fly really low in decent visibility than it is to bump up against the bottoms of the clouds where the visibility is diminished.
My definition of scud running is anytime I want to be higher and the clouds won't allow me to be higher. That's scud running, whether I'm at 3,000 feet or 300 feet. And the problem is, Mike pointed out, when we start scud running, first of all, we may not be legal because it depends on what class of airspace we're in. We should be 500 feet below in many places. But assuming we are legal in Class G airspace, it keeps pushing you down 50 feet at a time. And if you asked Tom how low he would fly, he might say 2,000 feet in this area. But, you know, it's 1,900 is just keeping him below the clouds. So I'll accept 1,900, and then maybe it's 1,800. So it doesn't, you know, if you sat at your home and said the ceilings are low, I'm not going. But you might continue to go where you wouldn't otherwise.
Those Alaska pilots have one benefit. They live in a place that's undeveloped. There are not many wires in Alaska. There are not many towers in Alaska. You know, I'm looking along, along a coast of a highly developed part of the world, which is why I have my concern about those towers, is there's just so much development and you can't translate there's definitely some Alaska stuff you can translate. Those ragged bottoms, that is exactly where you lose visibility. So you need to be well enough below those ragged bottoms where you don't lose that and get disoriented. Because you flew into the bottom of a cloud. But that's the other problem, is we're in the developed United States where there are just a lot of stuff. And when you get, as soon as you get low, you're in an environment, if you haven't briefed that, then you shouldn't be down there. If you don't know where the highest obstacle is, then you really shouldn't be flying on that flight path. And that's another thing. If you are going to be landing or flying the rest of the route low, land, make sure your path is clear, then pick an altitude that you will not drop below and then go for it if you have to.
Well, that makes me think, I put a question straight back to you, Mike. If it was low on both sides of the lake, which would you prefer? Scud running on the north side of the lake where there's virtually no civilization, or scud running on the south side of the lake where there are lots of airports but lots of cell towers?
Oh, I know.
That's
a quandary right there. I just said it's not Alaska. It's more like Alaska over on the other side. Well, the one thing that was driving us north is better weather. And again, that's one of the things that I'm wanting to be in the better weather. You know, if I have two bad choices, I want to be on the bad choice that gets me closer to better weather. But again, it's a quandary because better weather without an airport, it doesn't really get you that much. It just gets you a different kind. You're trading one kind of bad choice to another kind of bad choice.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I think in order to get to that better weather on the Canadian side, you have to risk that gray out over Lake Erie in the first place. I'm the first one to admit that it's easy to be academic about these things. And what I said about, you know, looking at the sector altitudes, it is highly tempting, as Wally said, to go just a little bit lower. And so you really have to think about it and you really have to plan for it. I flew a Cessna 150 from south of Atlanta to Wichita about three Augusts ago. And almost the entire flight was within 1,000 to 1,500 feet of the ground because of a high overcast. Excellent visibilities the whole way. I had more fun on that trip than I've had flying an airplane in a long, long time. And I got within 20 miles of home. My wife and my business partner were at the airport waiting to have dinner with me when I got there. I was bringing this plane to finish up his private certificate. You know, I was low enough. I'm getting cell towers. I'm texting, okay, I'm an hour out. And suddenly I came into this small area where the clouds were down. They would have caused me to go down to about 800 feet above the ground. And the visibility started to close in. And it was so incredibly tempting to say, oh, I'll do that last 20 miles. And what I thought about that, two things I thought about was, number one, I do a lot of this sort of thing, and people are going to bring that up if I crash an airplane. And number two, that even with all the experience that I have and that I think I have and the discipline that I think I have, I had to work really hard to get within 20 miles of home, having flown like about 9 hours that day, turn around, and I had to fly about 30 minutes to get back to the next airport behind me. But I did it.
Tom, what you just said is pretty amazing, because what I was about to say was to build upon what Wally was talking about is, you don't start out thinking, I'm going to scud run today. And if you look at our scenario here, it's pretty nice weather until you get to about Cleveland when the rain starts. And what happens is, hey, I'm comfortable. This is great. Oh, and now I'm at 1900. Now I'm at 1800. I've got, oh God, the visibility was terrible for 5 minutes, but it's better now. And what I've found, unfortunately, through personal experience is, once you are sort of in the pain level there, and it just continues, and you're more apt to just keep accepting it and accepting it and accepting it. And the deeper you go, the more committed you are to try to finish the mission. So, Tom, what you just said about actually getting 20 miles from home and turning around and going back and landing, I applaud you in a huge way, because I know how tempting that is and how hard it is to make that decision.
One of the big things here also is, you're in degrading weather. What's happening is, and I've seen this so many times, we get our head down in the cockpit. We are now worried about those towers. So we're looking down at, where's the tower? We're looking at the next rad radar. Talk about an opportunity to fly into a cloud. You know, you really, if you're flying in bad weather like this, you have to have your eyes out the cockpit at the same time. If you're trying to, make this safe by briefing all these things. That's why you got to do that on the ground. You can't brief in the air in marginal weather. You can't be trying to figure it out and making a plan on the fly and changing it and accepting these continued drops in your standards. At some point, get on the ground.
You know, when we were developing this scenario, Dave, you brought up the Corey Little accident where, you know, that they were in a Cirrus and with an instructor, and they're maneuvering in what you could think of as like an airspace canyon, right, over New York City's East River. It's kind of what you called it. And while it's not a perfect analogy, as you pointed out, it's like they banked sharply to avoid an airspace violation and lost an airplane and lost lives. And it would have been far better to accept the airspace violation and live to talk about it later. So if I could sum up this scenario, it's almost like the power of temptation and fear, right? The temptation to just continue on down the lake and a little bit further, and it's going to get better, as Michael pointed out, and the fear of like, well, there's something better, but there are going to be repercussions, and I just don't want to deal with the repercussions. And it strikes me sitting here that maybe those are two things that just have no place in a safe cockpit. Right? You want to guard against temptation, but you also want to guard against outright fear if it's blocking what could be the safer and better decision.